This show is a production of Migration Media. To learn more about us and see a complete list of our shows, visit migrationmedia.net.
From Migration Media, this is Migratory Patterns. I'm your host, Mike Shaw. We all need community, and nobody needs community more than people who move overseas. We leave family and friends behind when we move, and building new networks and support systems is vital for us. This can be an especially fraught process for members of the LGBTQ community. This week, we're collaborating with our sister podcast, Pop Abroad, to take a closer look at how one person is turning what is normally a hardship for queer expats and migrants into a business opportunity. While she was in college in Boston, Gabby Gabriel was in a long-distance relationship with her girlfriend in Belfast. When Massachusetts became the first state to embrace marriage equality, they thought that Boston was where they could take the next step together. But the U.S. government wasn't on board yet, and getting married wouldn't help with visas or green cards. So they decided to head over to China, where they could both find work. But more than just creating a community for herself, after a while, Gabby has found a way to leverage the privilege that she has as a foreigner to organize events and connect people and businesses in a way that supports LGBTQ people in a society where human sexuality is a taboo subject at best and a marker for outright discrimination at worst. Her venture, Community, is a platform that helps queer people find others like them and helps businesses become more queer-friendly. It's a remarkable organization that has already achieved some exciting successes. Gabby is a true trailblazer, and the way that she has been able to harness market forces to push for positive social change in a country like China is, I think, a model for the world. I can't wait for you to hear all about what she's been up to, so let's get into it. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Gabby Gabriel.
Gabby Gabriel, welcome to Migratory Patterns.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Where is home?
That's an interesting question. It's actually something I've thought a lot about. I think that even though I have lived in Shanghai for 7 years, and previously Boston, and before that I grew up in Cleveland, I mean, home is kind of where your parents are, and I mean, like, when you think about that home feeling. But also, I do believe home is something that exists from within yourself. You kind of have that home. I could be anywhere, like even a hotel in India, and feel like, okay, I'm feeling that home feeling within myself. And I think it's important to be comfortable being alone and having that feeling. But I do believe you can have more than one home. But there's something fundamental to where you started at all, where your hometown.
This is it's a rare answer in that not many people think about it, I think, in such a complex term and non-geographical term. But it is something that's come up with a previous guest where they talked about it's wherever their feet are, wherever they are, you know, their home anywhere. And it's kind of a mindset that I never really thought about before. I like it. It's kind of cool. Like, if you're cool with yourself, if you're at home and with who you are, if you're down with who you are and you feel at home in your body and your mind and all that, really you can be anywhere and be quote home. I like that.
Yeah.
It's a challenging notion, you know, because a lot of people, when you say where is home, everyone's answer is unique, but most people will find some way to talk about where they are geographically now versus where they came from. And they'll kind of draw some comparison. A few people will be adamant, my home is where I am now, or my home is where I originally came from. But it's a much rarer. I just gotta have to break down the statistical models because I'm at the point now where I've talked to enough people where I should start to see trends and start to, maybe I could publish a white paper.
That's true. I think people would find that very interesting.
Yeah, and our community of people who live overseas, international migrants, we're all gonna have different notions. But no matter what our notions are, we're still having the same experience and having to try to have some kind of, we're trying to get some certainty about ourselves and what home is outside our original context, which is kind of the challenge and what we're always talking about. So you mentioned you started in Cleveland?
Yes.
Cleveland rocks,
I hear. Yeah, I mean, it's a good city. I think it's a great place to grow up.
I've been there a couple times. I like it. I mean, you know, if you're going to spend a week, you know, a couple weeks, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is pretty cool. The waterfront's cool. Downtown's looking nice.
Yeah.
So you started in Cleveland, and you said you went to school in Boston.
Yes.
That's a great place to go to school. Great place to live.
It's a great city.
Yes, it is. What school was it?
Northeastern.
Northeastern University. Go Huskies.
Yes, go Huskies.
Were you just in Boston for university and you scrammed right afterwards?
Pretty much. I was in a relationship with someone from the UK because I studied abroad in the
UK. During high school?
During university.
Oh.
So I studied abroad two times at university, once in Australia and the second time in the UK.
Is it part of that five-year program at Northeastern that they do, where like the middle year you go somewhere?
So the co-op, well, I just chose to do that. You don't have to. But I just have always been interested in living abroad or traveling abroad.
It seems like it would be an unusual mindset for someone from Cleveland to have.
Yeah, well, my mom is from Brazil and my dad's American. So they were both, having that binational couple and having as a kid gone to Brazil and my dad traveling all around the world. He raised our family with an international mindset. I remember being like 3 years old and my dad with a globe teaching me the different capitals of the world and saying, you know, where we are is just one way of life, but actually there's many other ways to live and wanting us to really understand that, which was great.
That's so cool. Yeah. Can I have your dad?
Yeah.
I think all of our kids need dads like that. That's great.
Yeah, so he did a fantastic job of igniting the curiosity of the world. And although my brother and my sister weren't as influenced, it definitely reached me.
So then you went to Northeastern. You decided to do a couple of study abroad stints. You said it was Australia and the UK?
Yes.
Did they meet your expectations of what it would be like to live overseas? I know you said you traveled to Brazil. Do you speak Portuguese?
I can understand Portuguese fluently, but speaking it, not so much, because usually when I was growing up, my mom would speak to me in Portuguese and I would speak to her in English.
So was it weird to go overseas in college and everyone spoke English?
Well, it was a lot easier. I think I was afraid to go someplace. Well, I would have been okay with Spanish because I can speak Spanish, but there was a part of me afraid to go to some place that didn't speak English, which is so, I mean, in retrospect, ridiculous. But, you know,
well, baby steps.
Yeah, I eased into internationalism.
Yeah, living in the UK, studying abroad in the UK or Australia is like the marijuana of being an expat. It's
exactly.
Kind of the gateway drug.
Yes, yeah. That's exactly right.
Was that what sparked your desire to continue to go overseas? Like, was that kind of like a testing ground? Like, I'm going to see what this is like. And then once you did it, you're like, I need to be overseas all the time.
Actually, no. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed living both in us, and especially in Australia and in the UK. But I decided that I was going to be a lawyer and I wanted to stay in the U.S., and study international law. That was my original plan. So I didn't have, you know, these international dream, like international, like expat living lifestyle in the pipeline. It just kind of, well, it happened.
Yeah. Like, oops, I fell down and became an expat.
Yeah.
So then you finish up school, you finish up Northeastern, and what's the motivation, what's the impetus to send you off overseas?
So it's actually a pretty important situation that happened. I met a girl in the UK.
As one does.
Yeah, she is super cute. And we fell in love, started this kind of long distance relationship. She was living in Belfast, and from Belfast to Boston. I guess that would be a good romance title. And we were between Belfast and Boston for 2.5 years.
Ooh, that's, wow.
She was a bit older than me, and I was still finishing up at Northeastern. And, you know, marriage equality was happening in Massachusetts, and yeah. I was like, great.
I remember it well.
Yeah. I was just graduating, and I thought, well, I got a job offer in Boston. I was working at Pearson Education as a production assistant. They were doing some like content creation videos. And I thought, okay, well, I think I said to Allison, that's her name, do you want to get married and you can come live with me in Boston? We can end this 2.5 years, you know, of long distance. And she said, yes. And then when we looked into it more deeply, we realized that even though Massachusetts had marriage equality, the Federal Defense of Marriage Act prevented it being recognized federally. So she wouldn't be able to get the visa or the, you know, all of the procedures that our heterosexual counterparts would be allowed to have. Oh my God, it was such a devastating moment in time. I mean, just...
We have it, but we don't.
Yeah. And it was the first time I had realized the importance of these types of laws.
Yeah. I remember when I said I remember those days very well, I do, because it was, I was involved in politics in the early aughts, and I run a campaign for state rep, and I kind of got my heart broken during that process, because if you're really invested in the campaign and then only 17% of the population, the voting population, comes out to vote in the primary, you're like, what the hell? Why don't people care? You know?
Yeah.
And you kind of lose your faith in people. But then a couple of years later is when all the marriage equality stuff started. And I remember so vividly for people who don't know, we got marriage equality in Massachusetts through a state Supreme Court decision. And afterwards, there was this window of time before the ruling would take effect, where the state legislature, through the constitutional amendment process, would have the opportunity to override the Supreme Court and then basically put a ban of gay marriage in the state constitution. And looking back now, it seems kind of crazy, but it was a real danger. And I got involved again, and I loved being out in the streets. And I remember the night of the constitutional convention when they were having the vote, and this was going to determine if they would put the constitutional amendment to the state population for a vote. Like, it had to pass two sessions. In Massachusetts, you have to pass two sessions of the state legislature, this House and the Senate together. You get a majority two sessions in a row, so 2 years in a row. And then after that, it goes on the ballot to the people. And it came close. And the second vote came around, and there were tens and tens of thousands of people in front of the state house. And I just remember for days, just every day, just crowds gathering and people singing and chanting. And I was dragging some of my friends and marching them to their state rep's offices. And they were like, can we just walk through here? I'm like, yes, you can. You own the place. You know, it was so great. I was like, you get in there and you sign your name and you tell them to vote the right way.
Yeah.
And it was so just wonderful. And then of course, when the vote came in and they had failed to pass this amendment, so marriage equality would happen. It was just wonderful. And I was just so proud to be from Massachusetts. And I remember I had some friends, this wonderful couple, these two women. And I remember they were so adamant about not ever getting married. But after we got marriage equality, they said, you know, I think we want to get married. Like, it was this thing that you couldn't even fathom doing it. Like, you had been sequestered and denied access to it for so long. You could kind of see almost like an abused child. Like, you can't have this. You can't have this. And then the reaction is, well, we don't want it. Well, we don't want it. Yeah. It's not for us. It's for heteros or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then as soon as it opens it up and you're like, oh, you mean we can pay less in taxes and we can do these other things? Yeah, we'll take that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. But then your situation is different because you're dealing with this international thing. And that was a whole nother cohort of people that I had no exposure to at the time.
Yeah.
That's a really unique experience. So whatever happened to the girl from Belfast?
Well, we broke up after living in Shanghai for 2.5 years.
Oh, so then you...
So we lasted another 2.5 years.
Well, that's okay, I guess.
Yeah, it's okay.
Well, I'm actually eager to talk about some of the work that you've done since you came to Shanghai. It's how I've gotten to know you. But let's take a breath. Have a glass of water, and we'll come right back and get into your current life in Shanghai.
Okay.
Hey everyone, if you like the kinds of conversations that we have here on Migratory Patterns, you should check out Pop Abroad. Host Michelle Ibarra is on a mission to help expats and migrants live their best lives overseas by talking with the people who are doing it right now. During her first season, she's talking about community, why we need it, how we can use it to get a leg up, and how the best community leaders make theirs work. Listen in as she interviews the incredible women who are killing it overseas to hear how they are creating community in their adopted homes. You can learn more and hear the latest episode at migrationmedia.net or just search for Pop Abroad wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so Gabby, we were talking about your move here to Shanghai. So you started, you couldn't get married in the U.S. with your girlfriend, and then what made you decide, let's go to Shanghai instead?
Well, we wanted to live together. Moving to the UK was an option legally, but was extremely comprehensive and not necessarily ideal for my plan to go to law school. Since Allison was a teacher, I suggested, and I had just met somebody who came back from China teaching, I thought, oh, we could do that. Why don't we go to China and teach English for a year while Obama gets reelected and then gets rid of the law, which happened. We decided to move to China, and we made the decision in December of 2011, and then we moved to Suzhou in February of 2012, then moved to Shanghai in June of 2012, stayed for a year. Obama was reelected, and he got rid of the law the summer we went back to the U.S. in 2013. Mm. And we were planning on getting married legally, ended up not getting married, and both got interesting job offers back in Shanghai and decided to just go back.
It sucked you back in.
Yes.
So since you've been here in Shanghai, you've done some interesting work. You've got this business called Community, is that right?
Yeah, I just call it Community, spelled with a Q.
Community spelled with a Q. And this is, can you describe this to me? You were telling me about it before, and you describe it best. So please tell everyone what Community is all about.
Community is a social enterprise, and we've built a platform to help create a centralized location for LGBT people to find out what's going on anywhere in the world.
Wow. So this is like kind of organizing events, things like that?
Organizing events, community building, finding LGBT-friendly businesses, and anything that you need as a millennial LGBT person.
Well, if you're a millennial, you need an app. So
yeah, basically, yes.
It's funny. If you want to provide service to millennials, it has to come in app form or it doesn't exist.
Yes.
It's pretty cool. Now, I took a little peek at what you do, and you have this rating system, which I really like. Can you talk about that rating system?
Yeah, we call it the Q key.
I like that.
Yeah, so we didn't want to, it's not actually necessarily a rating, but more of just they either have this or they don't.
And these are businesses who get this, right?
Yes. So we wanted it to be like, you know, how can we really know if it's, we didn't want it to be a rating, but just factual. Okay, they either have had LGBT-friendly diversity inclusion training, or they haven't. Either they have gender-expensive bathrooms, or they don't. So we want the users to determine what they think about the place, and then, you know, thumbs up it or thumbs down it and write a comment.
Yeah, so it's not like a five-star rating. It's more like, here are these characteristics we would want from LGBT-friendly businesses, and they are yes or no.
Yes.
Okay. I liked it. What were some of the levels?
So have diversity inclusion training, gender expensive bathrooms. Do they have like an LGBT friendly safe marker?
Safe marker, what's that mean?
It could be a sticker or kind of a paperweight that we designed that would sit at reception that lets anyone in the community know, okay, this place is making more of an effort to be LGBT friendly and safe, and the person is able to come out.
Oh, wow. So now you're operating this kind of platform and this project in China. And can you talk a little bit about why you decided to focus on China as your market? And have you encountered any problems?
Well, you know, I started it in China just because that's where I happened to be. It wasn't necessarily intentional. The group I had started just kept growing because I think there's a particular need for LGBTQ-related resources in China. So that's basically why one of our main markets is China, but we actually also launched an app. We have a Chinese-only app for many purposes. Technology, it's easier, especially if you're a small company, to manage them on separate apps. So we made an LGBT China app, and then we also made one for the rest of the world. And creating technology stuff is so great in China. So it's just better to have the tech team here for now while we're smaller, and we'll consider opening branch offices in other cities later in the future.
So this is an app you can download now?
Yes.
And it's just called Community with a Q?
No, actually, on the App Store. It's better just go to our website because we're working on the next version of the app, and I'm not sure when this podcast is coming out, if the next version will be out yet or not.
We'll have a link in the show notes, and I'll remind everyone at the end, but that's good. That's good advice. I'm eager to see it. I mean, I like to, when I go back to the U.S., I love to see the little rainbow stickers in the window because yeah. Then you feel good that you're supporting the business.
Yes.
But then you go to some cities like a Seattle or a San Francisco, and they don't have one little rainbow sticker. They have flags and balloons and everything.
Yeah.
Don't see that here. So that made me, you made me think about that when you said they have like a marker or something, the safe space.
Yeah.
So is that something that is needed here in China?
Absolutely. People are, especially Chinese people, are afraid to come out. So any type of encouragement that can let people know that they're able to is really meaningful and effective and socially responsible.
Have you faced any trouble or any discrimination here?
Personally, not really.
Do you think that's because you're a foreigner?
Yes, definitely because I'm a foreigner. And then I use that to my advantage.
How so?
Knowing that I am not under the same type of scrutiny. I use, like, for example, when we hosted the gala last night.
This was a big community gala to celebrate the International Day Against Homophobia.
Yes.
Awesome.
And to mark our 5th year anniversary. This is a huge event. It was a huge event. Over 180 attendees, over 40 volunteers, and plus the chorus. I mean, there were at least 200 plus people there. For a Chinese person to organize this type of event, it could be much more risky because they have to expose themselves, and a lot of LGBT organizations run by Chinese people get shut down. But having me as the main organizer makes it more of an international activity, and then I can use the platform. Like, all of the hosts were Chinese, you know, the speakers were mostly Chinese, so as an expat, I can use my privilege to help the Chinese LGBT community have a voice.
Yeah. For people who aren't familiar with kind of the Chinese environment, maybe just think because it's a communist state, they're just cracking down on gay people because, you know, it's a communist state. It's a little more complicated here. There's actually been official statements by the government through the news service that gay people are equal and they deserve equal treatment and shouldn't be discriminated. But there's no gay marriage, no marriage equality, and the social stigma is really high because it's a conservative culture. What people outside China don't understand is, yes, they crack down on groups, but really they crack down on any group.
Yes.
Any group that is organizing people is seen as very... they don't like that, because if you're organizing for one thing, even if it's innocuous. That means you could organize for something else, so they would very quickly quash it.
Yes.
It's not necessarily they get quashed because they're gay, they get quashed because they're organizing.
That's right.
Yeah. But then you couple that with the social stigma and the family troubles and all the stuff that comes with being out here.
Yes.
Yeah. So what kind of support have you received from the community and from businesses as you've been spreading your message and your product?
Businesses, surprisingly, have been pretty supportive. I mean, I don't think they're doing enough, especially multinational corporations. But when we first started the QQ last June, A group of 30 of us broke into groups of 2 and 3, went down the streets of Shanghai door to door, saying, even these smaller Chinese noodle shops, being like, hey, we just launched this app. Do you want to register as LGBT friendly? You get a sticker, and then our community will choose your places first. And when we were doing that, over a third said yes.
Wow.
A third said no. And then a third, the boss wasn't there to make the decision.
Well, they were and just didn't want to commit to anything.
Yes.
That's pretty cool, though. A third. That's actually more than I thought it would be.
Yeah. It was encouraging.
Yeah. And have you seen that support grow? Has it been consistently? Let me put that in a different way. I know just from my own experience working with entrepreneurs that a lot of it is about building credibility with your audience or your customer base. So I'd imagine that maybe just going door to door in the beginning is a good way to start, but then they have to see some results from it. Mm-hmm. So have you seen the community responding to your saying these are your friendly businesses? Have the businesses seen value in identifying themselves as friendly?
Yeah, I would say they have. I mean, we didn't go to enough of them yet because this was just the prototype and we're testing things out. But the businesses even now continue to post on the app occasionally, just a cafe or like we discovered in the process some businesses that were LGBT owned that we didn't know about. And the community prefers to go to places they know are they're going to be welcomed.
Of course. I mean, I can tell you from my experience organizing, you know, doing community organizing with the vegans in Beijing back in the day is that once restaurants said that they would be welcoming and friendly, it's not the same thing. We're not an ostracized class of, you know, we're not a suspect class, but just the act of a restaurant saying you are welcome here and we're going to make this slight modification to just let you know that you're welcome here and here's some safe options for you. Just that makes the community support them, you know, because it's like, oh, we can go here. Thank you for just letting us know we're welcome. It's amazing how little effort they have to do and what a good response you can get from the public from it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So where does this go next? Where does this take you? I know you're just kind of launching this new version and you had this big event, which was spectacular and fun. Thank you. I am wondering where you see yourself taking this.
Oh, my goal is to make this the best LGBT app in the world.
Well, that's not ambitious at all.
Yeah. So I plan on coming to a city near you. Basically, yeah. I want to scale and grow.
So the community response has been good. You've gotten consistent response from businesses. Can you talk a little bit about, in general, what it's like to be LGBT in China? I mean, I know you're a foreigner and you have a different perspective, but you work alongside Chinese colleagues. Have you seen more people coming out? Are our attitudes changing? What's it like to be part of the community as you're working on this type of project?
Well, yeah, I would say that being a foreigner and LGBT is a different experience from being Chinese and LGBT. And I don't want to, I do think that it is much better than it was, but there's still a ways to go. I work very closely with Chinese people. I mean, most of our membership, so to speak, are 70% Chinese. And I think at the event, it was mostly Chinese last night as well. So it's about, when people ask me about the challenges that the Chinese community have, I would say usually the first challenge is self-identifying because of the lack of visibility and the lack of resources. And especially if they're not in a major city like Beijing or Shanghai, how are they going to even know if they are? I mean, they might be having these feelings and might not be able to get the information they need to really self-identify, especially for trans people. Then the next barrier is after they've self-identified is who can they tell? And that's a process that's particularly scary for people who are first coming to terms with their sexuality in China and in anywhere else for that matter. So usually people tell their friends. But the biggest challenge is to tell their family. Family pressure in China is extremely high.
Yeah, for people who don't know, this isn't so much a conservative culture, it's a Confucian culture, which is an emphasis on the family in a bigger way than we might be familiar with in the West. It's not just family, it's familial piety, which is like family values taking to the nth degree. And you are obliged to take care of your parents, and part of that obligation is to obey them, respect them, and produce heirs so that yes. you can help take care of them. Yeah.
Yes.
And you can't do that if you're, you know, theoretically, if you are shacking up with someone of the same sex.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is usually the toughest part, is how are they going to come out to their family? And I'd say for the younger generation, I've seen more people be willing to be more open and take the risks to come out. But for the old, like people older than 35, they're very deep in the closet, which is part of why community is so important here and why I've been trying to find a sustainable model to keep it going, is that there are very limited resources or places to turn, especially that are stable. There could be something that pops up, but how long is it going to last? And the stability is what the LGBT community needs in marginalized places. So those are some of the challenges. And then also the workplace. I don't think multinational corporations are doing enough to be LGBT friendly. I mean, especially if they're doing huge diversity initiatives in the US and then not doing them in other places in Asia. It's so hypocritical, and it really bothers me. And as an American, and you know, right now my priority is the functionality of the app, but once everything's under control there, community really wants to help hold these bigger corporations accountable for their lack of care and D&I in Asia.
As if we didn't have enough to be ashamed about as Americans right now.
Well, it's not just Americans, it's also European countries. And for example, like the gala last night, I invited the Italian consulate, the Spanish consulate, the Portuguese consulate. None of them even replied to my email. Meanwhile, the US and Canada, New Zealand and Australia all had some people in attendance.
I have to say, I was quite proud when Sean Stein, the US consul in Shanghai, got up and spoke at this event. Not only did he speak pretty eloquently, from what I could tell, he spoke pretty eloquently and extensively in Chinese and English, and was so supportive, told funny stories, tried to relate his experience as a straight guy just trying to come to terms in his own life with what is LGBT. It was really, I was really proud of him. And I actually had cornered him later on in the night, and I said, man, you're great. You're the first American diplomat I've met in a long time or even seen on TV or heard of that I've been like proud of. Like, great job. Keep it up. It was really heartening. I felt very proud to have someone representing my country showing support to a community like that, especially a community that I can never be part of or identify with, but at least want to support as much as I can. And it's kind of a unique experience that I don't know if you get that unless you live overseas. Like, we think about in the US, you know, Americans think about the State Department and ambassadors and all that stuff. And you think about all the politics of Senate hearings and who's going to get appointed here. But when you get down to the nitty gritty, the diplomacy on the ground, like, that's the real work. And when you see it happen and you kind of have this moment and you realize this guy represents us.
Yes.
And he's out there doing this awesome thing and showing support to this group. It makes you feel so good.
It's amazing.
It really is. You feel ownership over it as an American. It's really empowering. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it meant so much to me, the tremendous support from the US consulate for this event and all the support they give me for the community and the day to day.
Hell, I was proud of the Canadians. I guess this is just to say that when you kind of see the small acts of diplomacy that happen, as someone living as a foreigner in a country, and you see your country and other representatives of other countries doing those small acts of diplomacy and just letting people know, hey, we're thinking about you, we care about you. It's really nice.
Yes, for sure.
It makes you feel a little less separated from your home.
Well, yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, this is the importance of having events like this, because if the event never existed before, so there was never the opportunity for people to be able to show their support in a bigger way. So I think, you know, that's also part of why community is existing and thriving in China, is that we're giving people a platform to be able to speak out.
Well, it's a real world result that, you know, you've actualized this event, this thing, from your idea for this platform, this app that you're building, has translated into this real life event that, I mean, I gotta say, so many of the Chinese community members were so thrilled to that event. I remember this trans woman was speaking during the event, and she was on fire.
Yes.
She was great. She was like, what is the line she said? She said, I would rather suffer, be true to myself and suffer, and suffer insult than, you know, suffer in silence and be in the closet or something like that. And it was just like, man, she was so angry and passionate. I was like, you go.
Yeah, for sure.
Felt so proud of her.
Yeah, she was awesome.
Yeah. So this has been great. I'm looking forward to more events from you. I'm looking forward to downloading your app. And again, I'll have links for everyone in the show notes. But is there anything you want that the people listening to know, not only about just what you're doing, but about your vision for what you want this project to bring about?
I believe that what we're doing is organizing the LGBT community online. Once we grow in numbers and become a digital force, we can influence elections. We can go into countries where LGBT is illegal, and we'd have the financing to help do stuff about it. So I see this as a huge global solution through the power of technology to change the way people see the LGBT community.
That's awesome. Gabby, I wish you the best of luck on your project. I hope for lots of success, and I thank you so much for coming on to share your story.
Thanks for having me.
Well, there you have it. Please check out the show notes for links to more information about my guest and to reach out with questions, feedback, and interview suggestions. Don't forget to subscribe and to leave us a like on your favorite podcatcher. Migratory Patterns is a production of Migration Media and is executive produced by me. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
This has been a Migration Media production. To learn more about the lives of international migrants and see our lineup of shows, visit us at migrationmedia.net or look for us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.